Hello. Okay. I guess we start now, huh?
I guess so.
Anyway, I came down from the Navajo Nation to talk to Malin Parker, who told me at the time that ASU has gotten a federal grant to do Vista Volunteer training. And Vista Volunteer is an offspin of the Peace Corps program. And it's something that the ASU was very proud to receive. Mm-hmm. And Vista Volunteers were volunteers that came to ASU for their training. And those students were then assigned to an Indian reservation. And not necessarily with any specific duties except to help the community, mm-hmm. write proposal, make contacts for the local communities to outside businesses, and write letters, write resolutions, and in many cases getting involved in school community activities and all of that. But before they go out, these Vista volunteers had to be trained and become sensitive to Indian desires, Indian wishes, and the kind of activities that they can get involved in. So during the training program, while they were on campus here at ASU, we worked with them and placed them during the training as part of the training process and put them out in Indian communities. And my job was to bring them together in the evenings and have lectures on what they experienced during the day. And they were trying to get themselves involved and off the ground with some of the projects that they were involved in with local communities. And so that was my job, was really to help the volunteers. Mm-hmm. And it was done right here out of ASU. And so I did that for 2 years. And I really enjoyed working with many, many American Indian leaders, not only here in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. And I had to take these volunteers to the local tribal government. I also went and drove across the country to places like North South Dakota, visited the Indian tribes up there, and some of the Vista volunteers who were assigned to those tribes, into Minnesota, St. Paul, Oklahoma. And so I got to know many Indian leaders at the time. Here in the Southwest, it was with the Pueblos in New Mexico, and then practically all the tribe here in the state of Arizona. And so my job was just to visit them out in the field and give them some encouragement, and then try to correct some of those things that they ran into as a volunteer. And so that was something that I really, really cherish in doing that. I think I'll never, ever get involved in that kind of services again, where you had nothing. You didn't have any money. Pay-wise, yes, I was paid, but it was very little. Mm-hmm. And I had to live like the volunteers. Mm-hmm. And be able to start projects without anything. And it was just getting the community residents involved in solving some of their local problem. And so I left that after 2 years, and I think this happened in something like 1967. That's when I resigned, and or maybe it was 1966 I resigned from here, from ASU, and then went to work for DNA, People's Legal Services. I believe I was the second or the third person employed by the legal services program. There was a young man by the name of Theodore Mitchell, and then a Navajo person, Leo Haven. Mm-hmm. And I was the third one coming on board, and our job was to meet every day and to plan out the legal services program on the Navajo reservation. And once we started the Navajo program, then we branched out into Apaches, White Mountain, and out to the Hopi Reservation. And then we also took in other poor folks, all the indigent people in the Southwest. And so we established offices in Tupi City on the Hopi Reservation, White Mountain Apache, and then all the five agencies on the Navajo, then eventually branching out into Farmington area and Flagstaff and those places where there were high population density of the poor folks. And so we were, at that time, just representing everyone. And the money that we got came from OEO, Office of Economic Opportunity in Washington. And I remember it was right about at this point that Hillary Clinton, the senator from New York and now the presidential candidate, was involved in the legal services program. She served on the legal services national board that was appointed by a Democratic president. It may have been Jimmy Carter that appointed her. And so I had to work with all of the National Legal Services Board to keep the American Indian Legal Program going. And DNA, being the largest legal services program in America, it had a lot of spunk. It had a lot of good things that we were doing that attracted some excellent lawyers to the program. And my job was to recruit lawyers from across the nation. I always started each year, let's say at Harvard or Boston University, and came down to Yale, Cornell, NYU in New York City, and John Marshall in Chicago, and then here in the Southwest, University of Arizona, UCLA, USC, University of California, Stanford University. So I had on my list maybe something like 20 or so law school, and I kept a record of all the students that I interviewed. And at the end of their third year upon graduation, I just wrote them a letter and revisited some of them. And they came to work to DNA. And during the summer months, of course, they came to DNA on the Navajo, and we placed them out in the agency field offices to get their work experience. And so that was one of my responsibility for DNA. And as we were taking in cases, because it was a free legal services, we had all these Indian people that just came left and right, and our offices was always full every morning with people that came with legal problems, whether it be a divorce problem or employment problems that the Indian people were facing. Discrimination that they had experienced in the cities, and land problem, or problem with their social security, or problem with them being fired by the tribal government, BIA, Indian Health Service, maybe a malpractice case out of Indian Health Service. So we were involved in so many cases, an assortment of cases. There was just no limitation as to the kind of problems that the people brought to us. And one of the things that was an outstanding, two outstanding feature of DNA People's Legal Services that I really, really liked was, number one, it instead of putting out all of your workforce out into the agencies and they take in case day after day after day, which was endless, in terms of accepting those cases, we created what we call a law reform unit. That meant that you went out and you got the most experienced lawyer and put it at your central office, and all they would worry about is looking for those law reform cases where we can pick a case, one case, go to court, win it, and then that will allow all the other cases to follow suit, to follow the example and the decision that people derived at, and it covered some of the cases that were pending at those local offices. And so it ended up reforming the laws that were affecting the poor people here in the Southwest. And so that was an important feature. And we had some of the great lawyers with much, much skills. And we took from that law reform unit, took many cases to the United States Supreme Court. And I'll just talk about one or two of them. One of them was a McClanahan case. The McClanahan case was a case where Rosalind McClanahan was being taxed a personal income while she was working and living on the Navajo Nation. And we handled that case and took it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And the court ruled in her favor, and they said that she has her allegiance back to the Navajo government, and that she does not have to pay the state income tax, because if that was the case, then she would be allowing the state to tax her. Those tax money would be used off reservation to build roads and other infrastructure. And the Supreme Court saw where all of those monies were needed back on the reservation. So that was a very, very important case that DNA was involved in. Another one was what they call a controversial one, a trader case, where we had traders on the Navajo Nation. And those traders that were, at the time, doing business with the Navajo people, the Navajo people would pawn their saddle, their jewelry, any belonging that they have, they would pawn it with the traders. But in return, the traders did not give them any kind of a receipt, and the interest rate that they would collect once the Navajo people would generate enough money to get those pawn article back to them. And so there was no way of keeping a record of that, and the traders were really taken advantage in many cases with a non-English-speaking Navajo. The cost of cigarette would go way, way up high below the above the market value, and many of the items that they were selling there, the trader would essentially be the same. But what we were concerned about was the Navajo poor folks that were dealing with the traders, and how they the traders would intentionally lose much of the pawn article. And according to them, they would walk off the premise and you never see it again. And the poor Navajo people said, I pawned my saddle here and I pawned my jewelry here. How come it's not here? So that was kind of like an endless argument. That happened. So we brought in Federal Trade Commission to get after the traders and the BIA and have some kind of pawn ticket that they can issue to make sure that the interest rate that they were charging was reasonable. Mm-hmm. And then it was their ticket also to ensure that those pawn articles don't get lost and sold to tourists and other people. And so that was also a famous case that we handled. It was mandated by the courts to do that. Of course, there was the education. Right about this time, in late 1960, 68, 67, there were practically very, very few public schools supported by the state financially, and having those public schools located on the Navajo Nation. And I can think of schools like Chin Lee, for example, and Rough Rock, and Window Rock High School, Tohatchee High School, Newcomb, Crown Point, and Navajo Pine, right at the sawmill there. Those kinds of schools, they were non-existent. And it was through a case that DNA has been involved in that we handled through the federal system, where the judge mandated that these local school districts also build schools on the Navajo Nation as well as in their own county. And what really moved the Juts in those cases were how the Navajo people wanted their children to get an education. They were very insistent. And then the other thing that they really caught the eyes of the Juts was that, that many of these Navajo kids, when they get on the bus in the morning, they have to be bus 60, 70 miles, 80 miles away to go to a public school off reservation. And I remember a federal judge in Salt Lake City making the comment, when do they steady? If they go out into the street, go out into the highway at 5 a.m., 5:30 in the morning to catch a bus, and then by the time they get to their school, and then they're preoccupied with their class all day, and then get back on at 3:30, and then they don't get home until the sun goes down in the winter time. It might be snowing, and you let them off the bus at those highways, and when it's snowing, aren't you really jeopardizing the safety of those children? I remember a judge making those comments. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, they were all mandated to have schools on a reservation, and because of that, the birth of public schools on the Navajo. In the state of Utah, that was how the Monument Valley High School was built, the White Horse High School, and now the Navajo Mountain High School. It was really by a mandate by the federal judge, and they're still carrying out the spirit of that judge's decision or federal court's decision. And so basically that's the kind of cases DNA was involved in. And DNA was very, very controversial, needless to say, because of what we were getting ourselves involved in. And it wasn't really DNA employees sitting down and scheming and conniving as to what we should do. We were pushed by our clients. The Navajo people were really, really pushing us. And the last one I'll just mention is a case against the Navajo Tribal Council where the issue of reapportionment was raised by a Navajo client from Shiprock, New Mexico. And his question was very, very simple, where he said, if you look at the Navajo Council seats, there is a council delegate from the Western Agency that represents 200 constituents. And he goes to one chapter house. His constituency is 200. Hmm. I have a council delegate that represents Shiprock, and we have several thousand Navajo people that is represented by that council, the council delegate. But when the both of them get into an office, they vote on issues. And my council delegate is carrying the weight of several thousand people, while on the other hand, the other delegate is only representing 200. Where's equality? Where's fairness? What does the law say? And they wanted us to handle that case, and we had to handle the case. And so we went into the tribal court and handled the case, and the decision came down by a tribal judge that Navajo Nation just has to reapportion its voting district to reflect equal representation among the Navajo people, equal representation by the council delegate. And that really turned the tribal council and what they do and their responsibility and the controversy that it generated turned the tribal government upside down. And as a result, people were raising questions about what DNA was doing and why we were handling those cases. But people didn't understand that the Navajo also had a law called equal representation. and the Navajo Bill of Rights states that. So it was our own Navajo law that dictated that there's got to be fairness and equal representation. On the federal side, there was the United States Civil Rights Act that mandated the same thing. And so in our case, we were backed up by a federal law and by a tribal law. And that was very, very controversial. And as a result, the United States Senate and other representative, congressional representative, also start raising an issue on DNA People's Legal Service. And I could remember a book that somebody wrote called All the President's Men. There is a page or two that mentions and talks about DNA People's Legal Services. And as I remember, President Nixon got on the plane from Washington, and I think he was on his way to California, and he gave Barry Goldwater a ride to Phoenix on Air Force One, and the one or two other congressional delegation from Arizona also hopped on the plane. And one of the things that the reporter wrote that Barry Goldwater was concerned about, that he wanted to talk to the president, was how do you eliminate DNA People's Legal Services on the Navajo? And they're getting involved in a lot of these situations and that they should not be involved in, and that they wanted, he wanted to do something legislatively to limit DNA's ability to some extent. And so that it got to that level, and ultimately we also had to fight for our survival and managed to do that all the way from the Navajo Nation, local government agencies, all the way into United States Senate. And it was one of those things where you know that fairness could only be rendered by local people to the people that they represent. And here we were constantly suing the BIA, Indian Health Service, the state government. We were winning cases from those folks. But there were a lot of other people who said, hey, how come you guys are always after us? What about your own tribal government? They're just as unfair as we are, and you should also go after them. And so that was something that the people that we were always fighting with raising on the service, the kind of services that DNA was providing. And as I said, the end result was Washington having to make that decision to keep us going. And so basically that was my work for DNA. And the second features that I really, really like was we did not have one single Navajo lawyer at the time. Mm-hmm. And we brought in a lot of non-Indian lawyers from those schools that I named. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to see if there is a way that DNA can generate enough interest among the young people at the local high school level to see if we can have enough young people get interested in becoming lawyers. And at that time, it was considered probably not the right time to raise those kinds of issues. But we said that, well, we can't be any controversial than what we have done the last previous years. Why don't we just go into the high school and talk to the seniors and juniors and the sophomores every major high school on the reservation, we should go in there and explain to them what DNA is confronted with, and we don't have any Navajo lawyers. And so that was a systematic way of going after solving a problem that was institutionalized by the Navajo government and the Navajo people. And to change a big, huge government and the attitude, like the attitude Navajo Nation possess, that's really, really hard. And so we spent a lot of time educating the young people, and within the next 3 to 5 years, propped up a lot of Navajo youngsters that were interested in law school. And I'll just remember, and I just will name several of them to indicate the interest that was there. One of them was Claudine Bates Arthur, mm-hmm. out of Shiprock area, and she ultimately became a director of litigation at DNA. Then she also became the first attorney general for the Navajo Nation, and then she also became the chief justice of the Navajo Nation. And she was one of those individuals that we worked with at an early stage to get her interested in law, because she was so bright. And so she ultimately became an almost like an institution on the Navajo with that generation of Navajo people. The other one was a young man by the name of Herbert Yazzie, came out of Kayenta, and who also became the Attorney General and now is the Chief Justice of the Navajo Nation. I remember Herb Yazzie because he went to school. Both Claudine and Herb Yazzie went to school here at ASU. He was one of the first students at the law school. And then the other one was Louis Danette Sosi, who's now the Attorney General for the Navajo Nation. So these were kind of a representative of Navajo people at the time that grew out of that concern for getting more Navajo people interested in law. And I like that. I like that feature of DNA and DNA going out promoting that. Mm-hmm. Now, there was no rules or regulation within the legal services program telling us to do that. We just did it on our own, and because we knew it was needed. And I remember legal services official in Washington D.C. asking questions about how come we were, what were we doing in school, talking to the kids about DNA and talking about all of these things, and we just explained to them, you know, how that something like that was of necessity, and it wasn't something that we got together, connive and scheme on it, and decided that's what we should do. That's what people demand. They said, "How come we have all these non-Indian lawyers here? Mm-hmm. Why couldn't we have our own Navajo people become lawyers?" And that you guys should get involved in that kind of education and produce Navajo lawyers. And so, you know, within a short period of about 10 to 15 years, we were able to get 35 Navajo Indian lawyers. And I think that's a progress, a big, huge progress, mm-hmm. probably more important than mm-hmm. many, many of the cases that we ever mm-hmm. handle. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that that was close to my heart at DNA. And so that was kind of like the end of mm-hmm. my work with these different agencies on the Navajo. Mm-hmm. And then came 1983 when I decided to run for the... Excuse me, I should say 1982. Then came 1982 when I decided to run for the tribal chairman because I was pressured into doing it. I really, I really didn't plan it. I never ever thought that in my younger days that I would ever become a tribal chairman. But it was one of those things that you don't work at, but people notice and people will hear you, people will see how you have certain abilities. Perhaps that you ought to try some of those things that I keep on doing from the Navajo government level. And so I ran in 1982 and won, and then served for 3 years from 4 years from 1983 to 1987. And that was my involvement with Navajo Nation government. And since we're talking about education, there were many things that we did during those years. And I'll mention three or four important things that I think we did during the year 1983. One of them was the establishment of the Justice Department for the Navajo Nation. It was just barely getting off the ground when I took office. My people were telling me that we need to make it larger and bigger and really get serious about a bigger establishment of the Justice Department, because up to that point it was only two or three office people that commanded the desk at the Navajo Legal Council. So we made it into a Justice Department that Navajo people can be proud of. And again, my choice was Claudine Bates Arthur. That's how she became the Attorney General. And so we established that and got all these cases back from non-Indians that were representing the Navajo Nation. We had lawyers in Salt Lake City. We had lawyers in Phoenix and Washington, D.C., and they were handling Navajo cases, and we decided to take all those cases back to the Navajo in Window Rock and literally drove a truck around to haul all these cases back, and because we had established a big, huge Justice Department. And so that was one success in terms of what we were doing. The other one is the establishment of the Supreme Court. Navajo Nation Supreme Court was born during the first 4 years, and because there was a huge demand for that, and then people wanted to appeal their cases, and they wanted a Supreme Court that would be staffed with some knowledgeable people in law, and then the panel on the Supreme Court would be judges that came from the old Navajo judges that had a lot of sense of native justice, and they would bring that kind of school into the bench in the Supreme Court. And then the other one would be a recent law graduates, a person who's licensed in the state to practice law, and he would bring in the modern idea, the new justice, the new sense of fairness from the Anglo world, but that person being a Navajo at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle would be a person who would be appointed as a chief justice, working with these two justices that will have the ability to speak Navajo and English very well, that can look at both the traditional tribal judges' point of view and the modern young college and law school graduate. And so we created that Supreme Court, and to this day, as a result of establishing the Supreme Court, it has blossomed into something that is highly respected by all the non-Indian communities nationwide. The Supreme Court of Navajo Nation comes to these law schools like ASU, Harvard, Stanford, all these other major law schools, and they hold their cases there. And the judges, they were here recently at ASU. The judges use both their Navajo knowledge about custom and usage in settling tribal dispute, as well as the modern law governing some of those controversies or disagreements. And so it was something that we saw back then. And because of that, we created the Supreme Court. And I don't know if people know that I really agonize through who I should appoint to the Supreme Court. And these were all the things that were on my mind. And I had a vision in my head that we can't have that be completely dominated by the recent law graduates, because we'll lose the other part, the Navajo sense of justice. So we got to bring those elderly people and their sense of what is fair and what is just into the Supreme Court, and then we got to have somebody that appreciates both worlds. And so I agonize over that, and I am very happy with people that we appointed to the Supreme Court, and that's a huge success. And I guess the third one is the trust fund. I was very, very lucky, extremely lucky, to be put in office with council delegates that were highly dedicated. Their integrity was beyond reproach. They were very visionary in terms of things that they looked at. I just happened to be elected at the same time that the Navajo people elected them. So I give much credit to the tribal council that came into the office with me at the time in 1983. And one of the things that happened was that when we passed the Navajo Nation tax law, when we said we're going to begin taxing the companies that work on the reservation. And at that time, we had one or two taxes that had just been passed by the council before I got into office. And then we wanted to make it bigger, more fair, and have more companies pay taxes. And so we put all of that together and had a big taxing legislation that was passed by the council. Immediately thereafter, we got sued in a lawsuit called Kerr McGee versus the Navajo Nation, and where the companies did not want to pay taxes. And I remember calling a meeting of all of the companies that work on the Navajo Nation that were doing business. I remember calling a meeting and having them come to the council chambers, and where I had really talked to them. These are the CEOs, the head of the companies, and pleading with them, saying, let's work together, and we want you to do business with us. But they were so angry. They were so angry that the Navajo Nation saw fit to pass a taxing legislation so that they had to begin paying taxes. And my point to them was that, listen, everywhere you go, you have to pay taxes. And why don't you want Navajo Nation to do likewise? The company that you have business in Virginia, you have business in Appalachia, back east. You all have to pay taxes. And what do you make you believe that you can come to the Navajo Nation and expect not to pay taxes. We're hungry. We're short on revenues, and our people need jobs out there, and our people need services. It's badly needed, so we need to generate revenues. And they went ahead and filed a lawsuit anyway. Well, that suit was won by the Navajo Nation in my fourth year, and I told the companies that they could pay the tax that they're supposed to pay to the Navajo Nation into escrow account. And so that escrow, during that four-year period, had generated something like $217 million or $214 million during the time between the time they filed a lawsuit and when the case was decided in the Supreme Court. It generated that much revenues for the Navajo Nation. So my point to the company was, okay, since you sued us, you got to continue paying in escrow, into an escrow account at the bank, so that when the case is decided, when you take your money back, if we win as a Navajo Nation, then we take everything. And so the $214 million was then given to the Navajo Nation when we won the case. And the tax case. And the question was, what do we now do with that $214 million? And there were a lot of needs. The needs back then were the same as the needs now. And but the council were very insistent that if we used all of this money now, it won't really generate a whole lot of meaningful answers to our problem. Why don't we put it into some kind of savings account, and where we can generate interest out of those savings? So by having more discussions with money managers and people and members of the Budget and Finance Committee at the time, we decided that we should put these monies into trust. So we established something like seven trust accounts. Excuse me. Yeah, seven trust funds for the Navajo Nation. And there was a trust fund for the elderly, mm-hmm. trust fund for Navajo Prep School. There was trust fund for students who want to go to vocational education. There was trust funds for the scholarship funds. There was scholarship one was depleting at the time, and we had to replenish that. We established a trust fund for all the chapters, chapter houses. It's called the Nation Building Fund. And we had trust fund for the elderly folks, because up to that time, the federal government had decided that they're not going to fund the senior citizens program anymore, to buy them glasses, wheelchairs, these kinds of basic needs that the elderly people have. And so we decided that we should put some monies into trust for those folks. And so we have an elderly trust fund. And then the last one was the handicap. Next to the last one was a handicap trust fund for the handicapped people. And the last one was the permanent fund, and it was the biggest one. And the permanent fund, we put $26 million into trust and decided that the council each year should invest 12% of the total tribal revenue for that year into the permanent fund. And then the permanent fund, the interest that it earns would go back into the fund. So you had two monies coming into the permanent fund. one from the council, and then the interest that it earned. And I never, ever thought that someday we would be talking about having the trust fund reach a billion. And as of last week, I was told by the money managers that we are now at 958 million.
Wow.
And that during either this quarter, the end of June, or the next quarter, ending in September, that we would reach $1 billion. And $1 billion is a lot of money. And the council and I agreed that we would leave this money alone for 20 years, and we'll see how much money it generates. By all accounts, the money managers and people who do this for a living, they were saying that you will probably have 300-some-odd million dollars. And then here we are at the year 2007. It's at 958, and it's going to generate over a billion sometimes this summer. Now, I also talked to some money managers that handle these kinds of accounts that say if the Navajo people decide to leave that $1 billion in trust, leave it alone, then you don't have to wait for another 20 years to generate another billion. They said that it's going to be shorter. Mm-hmm. It may look something like maybe 16 years that it can generate all that amount of money within that period of time. And then if you want to leave the money in there after that and try to reach a $3 billion, then it's not going to take 16, 15 years. It's going to be shorter. So as years go by, that money that it's going to earn, the fund income, the number of years it could generate a billion is going to get shorter and shorter. And so it's something that we're very proud of, something that I'm very proud of. But I keep on going back to the council. If I was not put into office with the kind of council that we had back then, we wouldn't be talking about a trust fund that big. And I was extremely lucky, and I consider myself lucky to, and the honor of serving with that council that was elected in 1982 and took office in 1983. And so it was really because of them that we have generated this much money for the Navajo Nation. It's really done to ensure the future of the Navajo people. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be up to the young people as how they may want to use this. So that's kind of like a highlight of my first term in office. And then second term, we also did some outstanding work in terms of buying more land, adding more land to the Navajo Nation. And the reason why we did that is the Navajo population will keep on growing, but our reservation is going to remain the same. It's going to be the same size-wise. Mm-hmm. And we need to continue worrying about increasing the land holding of the Navajo people. And so during my second term, that was our major, major goal. It was something that we really, really wanted to do. And to do that, we had put some money into trust for what we call a land acquisition fund. And about two weeks ago, I was told that that is all the way up to 47, 48 million. So we have that much money to buy an additional land adjacent to the Navajo Nation. And that's in keeping with what we were doing in the first term. So it's something that we're very proud of. And there were also many other things that happened during that second term in my office. But since we're on education, let me just tell you also what happened. And this may lead into now our discussion on education. In my first term, in my first term, we decided with the education committee that what we really, really need is Navajo education policy, because we did not have any instrument, document, law, policy that indicates to the people on the reservation as well as the people surrounding the reservation, including Washington, what is our goal? Where are we going? Where do we want to go in education for the Navajo people? People were continuing to ask questions about how important is the language? What about culture? Aren't we really losing the Navajo language? And if you think we are, then what is being done to enhance the language? So there were many, many questions that were raised by the public, not only on the Navajo, but state offices, State Department of Education. And what that did is it brought on this whole idea that we should have a statement of purpose, and thus the birth of Navajo education policy. And again, working with that Tribal Council Committee on Education headed by David Soce, it did the job that that we needed to do, which was to establish and to have an act of the Navajo Nation Council clearly indicating that education was important and that how we wanted to enhance education. And that was the purpose of the Navajo education policy.
Okay.